Oh my God, there's a ghost. Andrew, look out, there's a ghost.
Oh, it's you. Hey, everybody.
Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Graham. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Mike.
Oh. Where's Mike? This is rubbish.
He was in Hamburg this week, wasn't he?
Who knows where he is nowadays? He's the Austin Powers of free software.
He was trying to get back from Hamburg to Munich today, but apparently he said, and he sounded incredibly apologetic, more for the German rail service, that they were having a strike.
Alles ist nicht in Ordnung.
I know. What's the world coming to?
Mike ist unpunktlich.
Does that mean the German trains aren't running on time?
Yeah, I wonder what they do. I wonder if the trains that are running are exactly on time and you know, they just kind of XOR out the ones that don't run.
Oh, well, without Mike, we'll soldier on somehow to the end of this, which is the Linux Voice Podcast, Series 2, Episode 20. I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Graham Morrison.
I'm Ben Everard.
Yeah, and after all this time, we still can't work out who goes when. Is it alphabetical order? Is it clockwise? Who knows? What we do know is that still to come, we've got news, discoveries, or even finds of the fortnight, and we've got a voice of the masses. We don't have any neurons because Mike's got all of our brain cells.
They're all in his secret briefcase that he keeps with him wherever he travels.
Yes, quite so. And if you like the sound of this, then you can subscribe to our magazine, What We Make, which is called Linux Voice. And that's at shop.linuxvoice.com. You can get electronic versions, PDF or EPUB, and paper versions, which are made out of trees. So, without further ado, here's the news.
The news. First item of news this fortnight is a little bit sad, really. It was quite sad. Linux Outlaws podcast is to end after many, many years of Linux podcasting.
2007, did they say they started?
Yeah, something like that. Yes, that's 7 years, if my maths is correct.
Yeah, that is a really long time. Yeah, they're both. So Dan and Fab, they both wrote quite excellent blog posts outlining their reasons, which aren't huge or dramatic. I think they feel like they can't do enough justice to their listeners, and they want to try something different. They did allude to getting together again in a few months' time, and they've had a bit of a break and trying something different, maybe with more people.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It must be a lot of work just for the two of them, especially as one's in Liverpool and one's in Germany.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is a huge commitment. I mean, it's a privilege as well, but it does take up a lot of time, and you know, especially when you're busy with other things in life.
Yeah, I mean, we're bad enough at getting together and it's our job.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, it must have been perhaps the most popular, one of the most popular Linux open source podcasts for all of that time.
How many listeners did they have at their peak?
Well, one of their posts made a reference to 8,000.
That's good going.
So, yeah, that is excellent. It's excellent.
Yeah. And of course, they're instrumental in OggCamp as well.
Yeah, yeah, of course. They're one of the two podcasters that kind of went into making it, that in UK Ubuntu podcast.
Right. So it's not as if Dan and Fab are disappearing from public life or anything. We'll still get the awful shirts.
Yeah, they'll be sadly missed, Linux Outlaws, and obviously we wish them all the best for the future. But let's move on to some happy news now. The Italian Supreme Court has banned Microsoft tax.
Ciao. They said that we know I like a pay at a tax.
This time, it's Italians legally not paying tax.
Ciao.
They've said that any companies that sort of bundle Windows along with their computers have to offer a refund for the Windows portion to anyone who doesn't want to use it, so who wants to install Linux or BSD or Mycos in its place. Which is, great news. They join quite a few other countries that have ruled similar things.
Do you think it's really that big a deal?
I think it's symbolic more than anything. I don't think many people will actually do it.
But it is. It's the symbolism of the thing. It's saying that it's a monopoly that's been created, that people artificially are paying for this thing that they may or may not want. Most of them do want it, but giving people the choice is, you know, choice is good.
I mean, there is actually an argument that you don't actually pay for Windows anyway, because all the bundled stuff they give you, the trial free stuff, the amount the manufacturers of that software pays is more than they pay Microsoft for Windows. Which is the argument why Linux is sometimes more expensive when it comes pre-installed on identical hardware.
Yeah.
Whether or not that's actually true, I've no idea. No company actually releases all that detail. It's all locked behind secret agreements. But it wouldn't surprise me if it is true.
I still say it's much better if you can to just buy it from a Linux vendor. You know, it supports them.
Yeah.
Linux vendors such as who? Have you got any in mind?
Currys?
So
I mean, the most famous Linux vendors are Xarezin and System 76. Yeah. Having never used a computer from either one of them, I have no idea.
Did yours come from PC Specialist?
Mine, yeah. It came without an OS. Actually, it didn't. It came with Windows, this one, because I needed Windows. But they would have done it without an OS. And they pre-partitioned it. So they put Windows on one partition. So I know it's not a big job to repartition your hard drive after it comes, but it was a nice touch. You could specify what partition layout you wanted, where you wanted Windows, and they sent it like that.
It wouldn't surprise me if Windows 10 is free, which may change things as well. In the same way that OS 10 has become free. How much money does Microsoft make from upgrades?
From home users, very little. From businesses, I would imagine, an awful lot.
Mm. Maybe the support. Yeah, you're right.
Let's move on to our next item. Real-time Linux is almost out of funding and may well cease to exist. This is a set of patches for the kernel that... real-time is sort of quite a confusing concept to often. It doesn't necessarily mean stuff runs faster. It means that it runs in a guaranteed time, or roughly in a guaranteed time. So you can say if this interrupt comes in, it will be handled within 10 milliseconds, 100 milliseconds, whatever. And this means that although your software won't necessarily run faster, you can guarantee the amount of time it will take to run, which in some cases is very important. For example, if it's a robotics application, it needs to deal with the sensor within a particular time, otherwise it could drive into a wall, just pulling an example out of a hat.
Medical equipment as well. I mean,
music equipment.
Yeah.
As my notes here, it's written, there's a knock-on effect here for audio distributions, because even though real-time isn't always essential, it did have some stuff, I believe, to reduce the latency.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I still run a real-time kernel on my audio setup, and it's just so much easier to get it to work decently with Jack, and you don't seem to suffer so many dropouts and things like that, but... Yeah, I always felt slightly uncomfortable, you know, building and installing the real-time kernel, thinking that really this stuff should be handled by the kernel anyway. Audio should be like a top priority process.
Yeah. I mean, the general principle is a real-time kernel should be slower overall, and a general kernel should be able to sort of smooth it out, but it can't guarantee the times. Yeah, it is a shame that the funding's dried up. I'm not too sure where the funding was coming from before. I would imagine
there must be lots of. I mean, maybe they do it themselves, but there must be lots of commercial operators who absolutely rely on the real-time version of the kernel and the real-time patches.
Well, in truth, I'm not sure how much Linux is used for hard, really real-time stuff.
Yeah, yeah,
there are other OSs out there that have much stronger real-time guarantees, and have been built with that in mind. Speaking of other OSs, FreeBSD turns 21. Or it's been 21 years since the first stable release. That's
excellent. Happy birthday. It's a long
time. Yeah, happy birthday, BSD.
You can, well, you can do most things now when you're 21, so, you know, be careful.
Take we'll take Beastie out for a pint. In America.
You can now drink alcohol in many US states.
It seems a little...
Was FreeBSD then only a couple of years after Linux?
Yeah.
After the Linux kernel.
They sort of, came about at a similar time. And Linus said a little while after that, had FreeBSD been running on 86 hardware, he would never have created the Linux kernel.
Oh, cool.
But, yeah. It seems strange that they both sort of popped up at about the same time, but there were other things going on with Unix around then as well, and copyright and whatnot.
It's been good having it there as well. I mean, even though I probably do use it on certain systems without really realizing it. The it's always good to have that kind of coercive pressure of FreeBSD lurking on the sidelines.
Yeah. Is it FreeBSD that OS X and iOS are built on as well? Or is that one of the other BSDs?
Yes, it's FreeBSD. Yeah, the Mac kernel.
Yeah, I think it is generally good as well to have these two OSs, both very stable, very prevalent, but under different licenses.
Yeah.
And they sort of mean that people who have a philosophical attachment to one of the two licenses have something to gravitate to and have a good system as well. I mean,
and I think BSD... Yeah, in open source terms, having the BSD licenses and having a workable OS or kernel with a license as liberal as the FreeBSD licenses means that we haven't put all of our, or at least 20 years ago, not all of the eggs were in one basket. So, you know, GPL being more restrictive, if, you know, you can see it both ways, the fact that, you know, we've got a choice.
Yeah. So let's shift back to Linux for a bit. Mozilla have decided that they're going to challenge Raspbian as the peak Linux on the Raspberry Pi. What they've said, this is obviously with Firefox OS, what they said is they're going to aim for parity with Raspbian as a hobbyist environment. So basically anything you can do on Raspbian, you should be able to do on Firefox OS for the Raspberry Pi. They're going to say they're going to be competitive with other media boxes, so with XBM, was it RaspBMC, and that lot. They're going to be competitive with other IDEs, which isn't really that hard for the Raspberry Pi, since the main one seems to be idle, which is all right. I suppose Scratch is quite good as well, if they're going to go down that route. There's more work to be done to get parity. Although Scratch actually is now web-based, isn't it?
Yes, yeah.
Although I say that, it's Flash-based, I think.
It seems, it's striking. I've played a little bit with Firefox OS when I've seen it on phones at conference centres, and I really like it. I think they've done a great job, but I don't quite get this. I mean, the best thing for me about Raspbian is that it's Debian, and there's a million packages, and that everything has been done a million times before.
And it's hackable down at the lowest level. You don't have to use Apache. You don't have to use Nginx. You've got everything there that you can pull bits out. You can push other bits in. It's a loose coupling of systems. It's not one whole thing that you use as it is. Yeah. And I've always thought that's kind of the point of the Raspberry Pi.
And I think that's what's made it such a huge success. It's the fact that you can... Nobody's really just plugging in an SD card and putting it behind their television and leaving it at that. I don't think.
Yeah. I mean, to put Firefox OS on it is kind of like saying it's just a low-power computer, the same as a phone, and
any one of the millions of devices that are now available.
Yeah.
So is that why they're doing it then? Why Mozilla is targeting the Raspberry Pi as a platform? If the tinkerers are already happy with Raspbian, then there's a whole other market of people that will do that, that will just stick it on an SD card and put it behind the telly.
It's quite possible, yeah, they'd be more competitive with something like Raspbian MC than Raspbian. And yeah, sort of make a smart TV type thing. They may also be looking to build their own hardware and using the Raspberry Pi basically as a prototyping board. Mm. Which is fair enough. It makes quite a good prototyping board.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
I mean, I think it's good that there's another OS you can run on your Raspberry Pi. It's quite interesting running React OS and Raspbian and all the rest of it. You know, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
But from the Mozilla's Foundation perspective, it seems like an odd way to expend resources.
Yeah, I suspect it's part of a more general desktop push than specifically just targeting the Raspberry Pi and nothing else. But we shall see. One of the things that I don't know, this actually scares me a little bit. They've said they want to enable programmers to develop robotics via the DOM and CSS, and they said one should be able to control a drone. And there's something that terrifies me about a drone controlled by CSS.
running on a Firefox or a Raspberry Pi.
Yeah, there should be laws against that.
A drone controlled by CSS?
The DOM and CSS. Presumably via JavaScript. But yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe you can put in the font that you want your lawn mowed into, and it'll go out and...
Like, if you mouse over a certain area, then that makes the drone fly left or right.
Tell the drone to not read the comments.
Yeah. But anyway, it's certainly an interesting project, although I am quite sceptical of their claim that they can challenge Raspbian. Yeah, it's the default.
Well, there's lots of people working on Raspbian, and, you know, Raspbian Foundation and Raspberry Pi Foundation works closely with them, and the people developing the hardware drivers and all the rest of it. So while it's all open source and they can obviously port all that stuff over to their own OS, it's going to be a challenge.
Right, last up on our news agenda for the fortnight is the NSA and Heartbleed. In a talk on American Election Day, Michael Rogers, the NSA director, has said that they didn't know about Heartbleed until it was announced on April the 7th. And on April the 8th, they gave a patch. They had this patch to protect against Heartbleed. And they gave it to various corporations and said, look, you can just use this to protect yourselves. You don't need to acknowledge that it's from the NSA. Just take it and make sure you're good and protected and whatnot. I mean, it was quite a flippant comment. He didn't sort of go into technical details about this, so we could be interpreting it wrong. But he definitely implied that he gave it directly to the companies and not to the project, which seems a bit backwards to me. It's like we've said, you, and you can protect yourselves. Here's some code. The rest of you, well, fend for yourselves. Which doesn't quite seem right to me.
Were they just American companies?
Well, again, he didn't say, but you would suppose.
Yeah. You would guess so.
I mean, that's their job, I suppose. But he did say as well that, you know, he was responding to allegations that they'd been sitting on this exploit for 6 months, you know, so that they could harvest all the data, which he refuted and said that wasn't the case.
Yeah, I mean, it's true, but it's also, was it him or was it a previous NSA director that said they didn't spy on thousands of Americans indiscriminately?
I so want them to be the good guys. I so want them to be protecting us. Why do you have to ruin it? Why can't I just sleep safely at night knowing that they're on our side?
Yeah, take the blue pill and it'll all go back to normal. You won't remember any of this. Yeah, and yeah, there's a second bit that concerned me a little bit as well, because it did seem to imply that companies just took code from the NSA, and I mean, you'd assume any company large enough for the NSA to bother with has people who can check it over and make sure it's all okay. They're not just here.
They'll just accept random patches.
Yeah.
You promised there are no backdoors in this.
There you go.
Yeah. Again, it'd be something that'd be interesting to hear more about, but no doubt we won't.
No. But I mean, it's the same with SE Linux. You know, maybe there is a good part of the NSA and what they do that is, you know, there in the best interest of the people who are implementing the technology they're using. They can't.
The NSA has two missions, broadly speaking. One is to attack baddies, and one is to protect goodies. Mm. And they are both within the agency's remit. And they're kept together because supposedly the skills are transferable. To do one, you have to understand the other. And there's an argument over which one is the dominating interest, and in each situation it's going to be different. But with something like SE Linux, it came in quite slowly. They didn't just drop this and say, here's a load of code, off you go, install it tomorrow, which is what you do with a bug fix. Well, a security bug fix, yeah, as serious as Heartbleed.
But you're never going to give a security bug fix to Google and expect them to not understand what it is they're implementing.
No, of course. I just think the NSA might see it as like a massive underhanded C contest. Actually, in other news, yeah, the underhanded C contest is launched again this week. Anyway, that's the news this fortnight.
Brilliant. Great news. Thanks, Ben. That leads us on to finds of the fortnight. So I'll start with the IRC channel, because just before we started recording, I asked the IRC channel if there was any finds they wanted to share with us, and had a fantastic response. So I'll try and get through everything, because there are some really good finds. Firstly, and I didn't realise this was such a big thing, there are many, many static site building scripts. So a website building script. So, you know, turn your XML documents into a working website, that kind of thing. And wearing shared Templar, which is a static site builder written in Perl. I had a quick look at the link. It looks really good. He also shared a link, which was staticgen.com, which lists, like, I don't know, 4, 8, 16, 50-odd static site building script generators. It's just a huge thing. I don't know. Does everybody create their own static site building script? I don't know, but there are lots.
So it's the idea that you have sort of a dynamic site that you add stuff to, but that's kept entirely separate, and that dynamic stuff emits static HTML that you then upload to your web server.
I think so. I mean, I didn't realize this was such a huge problem, but it must be, considering there are so many different solutions. But I guess it's just the same as us releasing, if we did do each magazine issue in XML, yeah, you know, we run one of these scripts to create the web version and the EPUB version and everything else, I'm assuming. And of course, documentation is a huge part of nearly every project, so there's a lot that, yeah, does markdown to website, so maybe it's the explosion of markdown that has led this. But then, I don't, yeah, know, there must be, I know that there are big things like the Ditter toolkit that does stuff like that, but maybe they're just huge and over-engineered.
Yeah.
James Olympus gave a link to a register story where the BBC clamps down on, well, it was to do with naughty iPlayer watching, but they did this by restricting RSS feeds and reducing the number of RSS feeds, which has broken a load of smart TVs.
When you say naughty iPlayer watching, do you mean as in people watching it outside the country and that sort of thing, or do you mean not using the official client?
It looks like they removed the RSS feeds and replaced them with an API. So without reading about it in too much detail, it sounds like the RSS feeds were accessible to everyone. But the going through, yeah, the API is going to make it harder for apps and other things to scrape, get access on whatever content is on the BBC.
Okay. And I did see that Get iPlayer has been updated.
Yeah, I saw that too. And so maybe that's it. You know, I don't know.
This seems a little odd to me, because why do they care what we're watching it on? I could understand it if there was adverts or something that were being stripped out, but there's not on the BBC.
I know.
Or if it was restricting IP addresses or something like that. But does it matter if we're watching it on Get iPlayer?
I can only imagine. Like, I think just recently the programs on iPlayer are now kept for 4 weeks, whereas before they were like 7 days or sometimes 2 weeks. So maybe in renegotiating these terms with some of the content providers, they've promised to look more into clamping down on the way that their programs are shared. I'm guessing.
Yeah. Okay. So presumably this is a problem for everyone who's got a smart TV that can't be updated.
It will be, yeah. Although I guess most smart... I don't really get the whole smart TV thing, but that's because I've got a PlayStation which seems to do everything that a smart TV would.
Yeah, we use a Wii.
Yeah, exactly. I did see... So we have got a smart TV, but it's just incidentally it came for free with the TV. And one of the horrific things about it, it's by LG. Every time you turned it on, it came up with effectively a banner advert across the top of the screen for something that LG was selling. You know, you could turn it off, but it was an option hidden within the settings. And so that's what I kind of think of what smart TVs are for. So we've got another discovery from Dutchie. He's... They've linked to Tarsnap, an online backup for the truly paranoid, written by FreeBSD Security Office, strong crypto, bug bounties, and compression deduplication. So he says, for as an example, his laptop backup would normally total 8.6 gigabytes, but compresses and deduplicates down to around 650 megabytes. So looking at the website, it looks really good.
So is it a service or is it a tool?
It's a service. It's probably a service and a tool, but having not looked any more than followed the link, I mean, I can see that they're charging $250 a month for storage.
Brilliant.
And it's $250 a byte. So that's like a quarter of a cent per gigabyte. Which sounds great.
that is pretty good.
I might have to have a closer look at it, especially if it's got the backing of FreeBSD and OpenSSH and all that kind of stuff. So it stores encrypted backups on S3. Yet Twisted Lucidity makes the point that Get iPlayer has been patched. Enom says he gives a link to. This is an excellent link, actually. The UK government's community development handbook, which is excellent. I don't know if we mentioned it before, but it's a really good website, basically, all about managing community in a kind of John O'Bacon kind of style, but you know, written with a government perspective
by civil servants.
No, but it's in their new kind of gov.uk, you know, nice, friendly, big CSS way. It looks really useful.
Uh-huh.
So it's the idea they've cut all the social services and replaced them with a handbook to recreate them by yourself with no money.
I think, maybe. But it looks genuinely useful if you're looking for a way to start and you know, you need some other option, because there isn't actually that much stuff on there on building communities. It's a weird kind of nebulous term that only kind of happens maybe when it's too late. And then finally, Alan Pope has got a couple of discoveries. Finds. The first one looks awesome, and it's an open source media server called Media Browser. And only having followed the link, it looks awesomely professional. If you go to mediabrowser.tv, you basically install the server on your Linux box, download the apps for your Android phone, and just enjoy your media. It's as simple as that, a bit like kind of Pogo Plug or one of those old services. But the fact that it's open source, he does make the caveat that it requires mono. If you're happy to live with mono, then it looks fantastic.
So is it for streaming stuff to Android devices? Yeah.
I'm guessing it doesn't have to be just Android devices, but I don't know if there's an iOS app as well. But yeah, basically it looks as simple as install your server somewhere, put your content on the server, and then you can access it from everywhere. Just like lots of people are trying to do, but it always ends up, when you try and do it, requiring quite a few more fiddly steps than they kind of give the impression of.
Yeah.
He also, Alan Pope also mentions that, is it the Yola? Is that how you pronounce it? The Yola phone.
Yola.
Has a, yeah. Yola has a community-run Kickstarter, which may be interesting. It uses their other half technology to make a physical keyboard. It includes €100 cashback on the phone if you're interested. So I'll provide that link as well in the notes to the Yola's. It looks really nice. It's like one of those old HTC phones with a sliding keyboard.
The other half was the case that actually interacted with the phone, wasn't it?
Oh.
If I recall correctly.
Right, okay.
So like the first one, if you put a different colour case on, it changed the colour theme of the UI.
Okay. So this is this. It looks like it goes beneath the case and it gives you a full QWERTY keyboard to go along with it.
Okay.
How much is it? Let's quick down. Bare DIY edition is €60.
Mm.
A fully built one is 100. So they're the finds. Sorry, Ben.
Yeah, the Yola phones look really nice online. I've just never seen one in real life.
Yeah, I haven't seen one either. We should try and get hold of one.
Yeah.
And they're the finds from the ISE channel. Much better than Wi-Fine. I've got two finds, actually. Shall I talk about them?
Because yeah.
the first one is... so after Ben talked about Google Cardboard in the last podcast, was it just the last podcast? I ordered the official kit from someone on eBay, which incidentally cost about £10 and came with everything, and the lenses and the RFC chip and a band to tie around your neck. And I loved it. It worked absolutely brilliantly. Everything that Ben said about virtual reality on the cardboard is true. I mean, we had a really good evening here just trying out things, the tour of Versailles and looking at photos and the panoramic shots. It's really not at all bad at all, considering it costs so little, except for it doesn't cost only £10. It costs about £350 if your phone slides out of the front of the cardboard and lands on the floor.
Oh, no.
So I can't show you podcast listeners, but here is my Nexus 5.
Oh, no.
Oh, dear.
Literally, it fell out. It was only about 4 feet, and it fell onto the corner of the hard floor, and the screen is shattered. Now, yeah, it's really bad. It's really bad. However, it's just the screen that's broken. Now, the Linux voice salaries don't quite cover us for me replacing it with anything, really, but especially not a Nexus 6 or a Nexus 5. So I've ordered... So the screen and the touch-sensitive area and the glass is all bonded. And it's not an easy replacement. I've been looking into it, but you can buy them all bonded together with a frame for about £60, which I've ordered now. And I've watched the teardown videos. So my discovery, having yet to do it, is actually that the Nexus 5 looks incredibly user maintainable. It looks quite accessible. So I've got to take every single component out of it, replace it with the new frame and screen and everything that I've bought and put it all back together. But unlike many other phones, it actually looks pretty straightforward. I don't really fancy the idea of doing it. It's going to take a couple of hours probably, but it means that I'll get my phone back without spending a fortune.
Okay, I've got two finds. First find number one is the Free Software Foundation has invited people to nominate our heroes for the Free Software Awards. What a lovely idea. There's an award for the advancement of free software, and there's an award for projects of social benefit. And there's some words in there about eligibility and what to do. But you have to send your nominations to awardsnominations@gnu.org on or before Sunday, November the 16th. So you've got time. You know, there's a week or so in order to tell the GNU people how awesome your favourite stuff is. There's one of the great things about this that it always tickles me. Individuals who describe their project as open instead of free are eligible nonetheless, provided the software is in fact free/Libre. Brilliant. Thanks for clearing that up.
And the second thing is story picked up from the Inquirer, although it's been pretty much all over the internet lately. China will move to Linux by 2020 in de-Windowsifying process. I love that, de-Windowsifying. It's literally a 5-year plan.
Have the Chinese government actually said they're going to Linux, or have they just said they're leaving Windows and everyone's assumed they're going to Linux?
Everyone has assumed that, yes. Well, there is Kylin, which
yes,
is Kylin. Chinese. And does that have some sort of official affiliation with the Chinese government, Kylin?
I'm not sure. It doesn't seem to be touted as such, but there may well be a link there.
No. Nor am I. Well, they don't really need to spell out that it's Linux. I mean, if China's gonna produce its own government sponsored operating system, then what else would it be?
Maybe Tim Cook's rubbing his hands.
Maybe red apples are on the way.
Mm.
But the de-Windowsifying. It sounds like, you know, re-education, like. You know, all of your machines are belong to us now. It's something really quite sinister, but also epic.
That surprises you.
it is just the government computers, isn't it?
Oh, obviously,
they're not going around the countryside with installed CDs.
No.
Small vans parked outside people's houses waiting for that little Brian Eno startup sound from Windows.
Yeah, so well done.
Just go out to
well done, Chinese government. It's that's what you can do when you've got, you know, an enormous pool of slave labour and absolute power.
Willing slave labour, we should point out.
What was that?
Willing slave labour. Oh, obviously. Yes. No one's unwilling willing to work for the glorious government.
Those are my finds. Oh, and I won the pub quiz the other day. That's not a find. I just thought I'd throw that in there.
Well done, Andrew.
It's a crushing victory.
I've been making a few finds this fortnight. The first one, I'm cheating. I didn't find that this fortnight. I found it the previous fortnight, but I'm only announcing it now. I was DDing a distro Arch actually onto a USB to install from it, and I've been using my laptop for a while. And you get used to DD slash dev slash SDB, second hard drive on my laptop. My desktop has two hard drives. And for some reason, the USB stick always comes up as SDG. I've no idea why it's not SDC, but whatever. But anyway, muscle memory kicked in and I DD'd it to my second hard drive. And I was like, oh.
What was on the second hard drive?
Well, there's two partitions on my second hard drive. The first one's an NTFS partition that I just use to share data between Windows and Linux. Fortunately, I hardly ever use that hard drive, so there's nothing important on it. The second partition was it's my major partition, really. It's the second hard drive is my biggest one. I've got a small SD. SSD. Which just has the OS and the files and programs and stuff on it. And all my data's on their second partition. So had I lost it, I would have been in quite a bit of trouble. Fortunately, obviously, the ISO that I DD'd was, I can't remember, less than a gig, I think. So it didn't get as far as the second partition. Wow. But it obviously wiped out the partition table. So I needed some way to recreate this. And I found, so this is my find, test disk. Is a bit of a weird name, really, for a tool that fixes disks. Yeah. But anyway, so I don't recall exactly how it worked, but I think it was cursors-based, and it was very straightforward. I just sort of hit return a few times and set it running, and it whizzed away, and it managed to recreate the partition table, at least for the second partition. So, and now it works fine.
That's brilliant. I think... Years ago, one of my discoveries was test disk for exactly the same reason. Yeah.
Really do need... it probably exists. It probably is a DD tool that you can just alias to it, and all it says is, that is not a USB drive. Do you really want to DD to it?
Yeah. Yeah. DD is such a dangerous tool.
It's being used far... Well, I use it far too much, really.
I mean, even now when I use it, I still quickly check the LED on the USB device to see that it's actually working. And if it isn't flashing, I'll be like, Control-C, Control-D.
That's what alerted me. I was like, hang on, that should be flashing. But it's too late then.
Yeah, it's too late.
But anyway, I did manage to get back my data partition. And that, if I tried hard, I probably could have got quite a lot of files off the NTFS partition, but there was nothing important on there.
I think Test Disk is part of the kind of the project that comes up with Photo Rescue as well, isn't it? The kind of file, it scans through all the blocks on your hard drive looking for files.
Yeah, I have used Photo Rescue before, and it's really good for rescuing far more than photos. Mm. It's a general file.
They seem to have a naming problem, whoever comes up with those tools.
Yeah.
Crippled by modesty.
I suspect both of them have just grown far exceeded their initial scope, as programs are wont to do. But, yeah. So my second find, anyway, is... I decided to try out this whole tiled window manager thing. I tried Xmonad a couple of years ago now, and I liked the idea, but I don't know, perhaps I just didn't persist with it enough, really. I just switched back. So I thought, all the cool kids seem to be using i3 these days. So I've installed i3, put on a pair of thick-rimmed spectacles, and joined the cool kids. It does take some getting used to, but it actually started with the EPUB. The first EPUB I put together, it gave me really bad RSI in my mouse hand. There's just so much clicking. The workflow for EPUBs on Linux is terrible. So I thought, well, maybe a tiling window manager will help this. And it actually has. It's got a lot better. It has taken some getting used to, but there's a lot less key combinations to learn than I thought there would be. I thought I'd spend like weeks memorizing all the various control alt things, but actually there's only half a dozen that you really need to know to get started, and they came very quickly. And within a day or so, I was almost as efficient using a tiling window manager as I was using a stacking window manager. And my hands hurt less. So win.
That's really good.
I still have Mate, and occasionally I boot into it. Just
Mate.
There's some tasks that... Mate. There's some tasks that I just find works better if I need to use a lot of windows for something. But generally, i3 works really well. And actually, the range, and I'll throw in another bonus find, which I wasn't going to. Ranger, file manager.
Leave it to brew for next one.
Yeah, oh, I shouldn't know. No, forget all about the Ranger file manager. Now, it's a cursors-based file manager written in Python, I think. And I've used Midnight Commander in the past, and just it works reasonably well, but yeah, I've always preferred a graphical one. But Ranger is the first cursors-based or terminal-based file manager that I've actually found could really replace a regular file manager for me. And it's actually much faster once you get used to it, which isn't that surprising, really. Most terminal stuff is once you get used to it.
Mm.
But I'd recommend giving it a go. And those are my finds this fortnight.
Excellent. It's an awesome find section. Thanks.
Yeah. That's a bumper find section, which takes us to about
the IRC channel.
About 50 minutes in. So it's time for the halfway reminder. Still to come, we don't have any Vocalize Your Neurons because we don't have any neurons to vocalize, but we do have the Voice of the Masses. It's time for Voice of the Masses. So, we asked... The question is, it's a simple question, it's GCHQ is upset, does this mean we're winning back our privacy? Now, we asked this because Robert Hanning, who is the boss of GCHQ, which is the UK government spy agency, that spies on us with spies. he's upset because technology is making it harder for them to do their jobs properly. The private citizens are getting their hands on more stuff that enables us to conceal our stuff. Oh, that's just rubbish. Why have I forgotten how to speak English? We're getting our hands on more technology that is enabling us to keep our lives more private. And that's obviously good and bad. One of the downsides of that is that spies can't spy on us as effectively as they could in the past. So our question is, if the head of GCHQ is upset by this, does that mean we're winning back our privacy? Is this a genuine plea for us to give up our digital rights, or is it just crocodile tears from someone who can still trace every click we make and message we send? Only 12 comments.
Which isn't bad, really, considering we only asked about 18 hours ago.
That's true, I suppose. So we'll get started with Nanu, who says, "This is just subterfuge in order to make us think it is safe once again to use the systems we once trusted before Snowden blew a massive hole in them. I have no doubt mass surveillance will continue as it did before, and that the best way for them to cover up is to pretend that the software companies really care about our data and that the government agencies have no way of accessing it." And then there's a little yellow emoticon that's winking and smiling. Just like that, Graham. Just like that. A few people have said that. Who else? Banana Joe. I can only say what Nanu said. He's trying to make us think we're winning, but we're not. It's a typical political statement. Be careful and don't let his statement lull you into thinking you're safe now. Michael Burke says, "The boss of GCHQ moaning about this is like the gambler at Las Vegas moaning that his little device for cheating cards has been discovered." Ah. Does anyone remember when the UK government wanted to pass those snooping laws? William Hague, greatest living Yorkshireman my arse, I'm not even from Yorkshire, said, "If you have nothing to hide, then you have nothing to fear." What? All this means we're not winning back our privacy. If we continue to give up our information for free, we have no right to protect it. And really, if GCHQ really want to spy on us, they will. We're just making it harder for them. Yeah, fair enough that. You two chaps?
I think there's a few things. Some of it probably is making it more difficult for GCHQ, especially more, not necessarily the technology, but the fact that people are actually thinking about it. So perhaps people aren't just putting as much stuff on there and whatnot. I could be wrong, but I do seem to be getting that impression that there's less.
It's in the interview in issue 10, I spoke to Tim Bray, who does many things. He at the moment he's really into security and encryption, and he made the point that it doesn't take that much of an increase in people using GNU PGP or HTTPS to make the security services jobs exponentially more difficult, just because of the amount of calculation and storage that needs to be done. And you know, so it only probably needs twice the number of people using encrypting something or thinking about it or removing their place to double or quadruple or the amount of effort involved in getting anything meaningful out of the data. So the fact that there was perhaps nothing effectively a few years ago to the fact that there are now people, and probably people who care about it are the people that the government's most interested in.
Yeah, there's something I heard someone from the Tor Project talk about, and that's that the importance of people who aren't in immediate danger using the Tor Project, because it adds noise. If it's only activists and whistleblowers, etc., using encryption, then it's really easy. Oh, yeah. It's really easy to find out who you want to spy on. But if general people are using it, even if it's not necessarily that many, yeah, it adds noise. It means that you can't just pick up, oh, this person's using encryption, they must be up to something wrong. Let's clobber them.
Yeah. I mean, that argument's been going around for years. I remember that when people first started suggesting encrypting your email, you know, everybody encrypt your email, please, you know, because it, you know, adds to the noise. It is really important. I do think we should all be using encrypted email. I don't know how we can make it work or how we can make it happen, but
I still don't understand why we're still using email, to be honest. It's such an outdated technology that's just, it was never built to be secure, and none of the security built on top of it has ever really worked. Not from an encryption point of view, but from a usage point of view. Surely there is some better system, but who knows?
Yeah, I don't.
Maybe we should all use Facebook chat.
I hate email. As anyone who ever emails me must know.
Some practical advice here from Martin the Marvelous. He says, if you want to, you can get a lot of your privacy back. The problem is that it is just not cool, it seems, to care about your privacy these days. Whenever you start talking about privacy issues concerning the internet at a party, people will roll their eyes and make remarks like, you are just not ready for internet. To be honest, I didn't know about the Tor service provided by Facebook either, nor did I bother to fill in a fake email address at this comment forum. As long as we are willingly putting our personal information on public websites, privacy will be an issue. But then again, people just don't seem to care that much. Perhaps in the future that will be different. So what's this Facebook Tor thing? I didn't know about that either.
It's a recent thing. They've opened up a hidden service. A hidden service is basically just a website that's hosted inside the Tor network. So usually when you use Tor, you connect to the Tor network, it's scrambling and anonymizing, and it pops out an exit node back onto the internet. So it can still be, the communication from the exit node can still be monitored by your NSAs, your GCHQs, whatever. They just can't tell, well, they probably can't tell who it comes from, but they can tell who it's going to. With a hidden service, it never leaves the Tor network. So you connect directly to the Tor network, the websites in the Tor network, and everything's anonymized and encrypted. So it should be more secure. Obviously, if you then log into Facebook using your real name, as you have to do if you're following their terms of service, the anonymization part of it is somewhat moot. However, it would do things like hide your location and potentially it could be used to get around Facebook blocks in countries that block Facebook or any other organisations that block Facebook.
Do you think that's their motivation for doing this? Because it seemed somewhat ironic. You know, maybe they just want people in China to be able to access Facebook.
It could be that, although accessing Tor in China is somewhat risky. Although not impossible anymore.
But just to access Facebook might not be worth it.
Yeah, to be honest, I can't help thinking it's just an easy win. They were like, oh, we haven't been in the tech news for a while. Let's do this. It must have been very easy for them to set up. And
a lot of the kids use the Facebook Messenger service as an email replacement.
Yeah.
So if that's has Tor built in, then that's, you know, that's great, surely.
Well, it's still obviously linked to your Facebook profile. And Facebook can obviously see all the messages that are being sent, and anyone who Facebook are telling about the messages being sent can see all the messages being sent. So it's nothing like a replacement for Tox or off-the-record chat or anything like that. I think it's a good thing because it starts to legitimize Tor more. It is putting their name behind it and saying, Facebook use it. Because before, the only big thing using it was Silk Road. And
yeah, you're right.
It didn't necessarily have the best.
But making it seem a normal part of the internet, you know, it means that it doesn't, you know, I could speak to my uncle and he doesn't immediately think I'm a criminal when I mention Tor.
Yeah. Yeah, I do struggle to see a practical use for it, but...
Craig, back to the comments section, says, I'm not sure if we're winning back our privacy, but I'd love it if you could interview him for the magazine or podcast. That's the GCHQ chap. If only we knew someone who was travelling to the Cheltenham / Gloucester area this weekend.
I did once ask to be given a tour of GCHQ for a magazine feature. They said no.
No.
They didn't say no outright, actually. They did consider it and then said they couldn't schedule it.
We should ask again.
We should.
It sounds like that'd be interesting. Frank Bell says, as long as Facebook, Google and other corporations make using the internet an exercise in being naked in public, internet privacy is nothing. It beats me why persons complain about this or that government agency, then voluntarily run naked through Facebook.
Yeah.
a fair point, although it's probably not the same people complaining about the government agency that it is putting nudie pictures up on Facebook. I know that was a metaphor, but yeah.
I do think we need to have some kind of scale of privacy issues. You know, like most of us have got a mobile phone in our pocket that logs everything that we do. You know, we take pictures with location data in. There's stuff that you don't often think about or you share with. You know, that reveals everything. And then to encrypt a few emails or to access a certain website through Tor is kind of small scale in you know, comparison to just things that you do without even thinking about it. Like put your phone in your pocket. You know, there needs to be like a scale phone, you know, Facebook, email, buying stuff on Amazon, whatever you happen to be doing, buying a subscription to Linux Voice.
Yeah, I think it is going to be a gradual thing to change it, though, because at the moment you can't really wholesale turn around and say, I want to go around unsurveilled. The amount you'd have to cut out of your life would be phenomenal.
You'd have to never leave the house, for instance.
Yeah.
Which is okay for
us.
But
if you can just gradually...
Sorry, Ben.
Yeah, but if you can gradually take it back bit by bit, then maybe in a few years it will... we will start to have some semblance of privacy again, but it does need a long-term concerted effort rather than, you know, it's not going to happen tomorrow.
I'd like to leave the last word on the comments section to Stuart, because he's right about everything. And Stuart says, the problem is not that they intercept everything. There are legitimate cases where this is appropriate. The problem is that there has been no debate on when and where the access should be allowed, on what programs they are allowed to have, and any oversight of their activities. Theresa May, that's our Home Secretary, keeps going on about how there is strict procedure and oversight, but this is all secret. It must be public. I'm sure that their oversight was just as effective as the Stasi. The bogus excuses of terrorism and child pornography are trotted out every time as reasons, but when pressed, they cannot provide examples where this information helped to convict anyone. We in Europe, having people who lived through the Cold War, and even the Irish Troubles, know that terrorism is defeated through dialogue and the fair application of the law.
Wow, yes. You're right.
You're right, he is right about everything.
All of that. He's right about everything. And you can find that comment and other sensible comments at linuxvoice.com if you go to the podcast's Voice of the Masses section.
And I think that pretty much wraps up this podcast, doesn't it, on this cold Thursday morning in November. So,
So join us in 2 weeks.
Yeah, join us in 2 weeks. Hopefully Mike will be around then.
Hopefully.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.